Sometimes it feels like the news is full of things that have never happened before. And that is not exactly true. In fact, it may have happened this very week, hundreds or thousands of years ago. I'm Sally Helm, host of the podcast History This Week from the History Channel. Trade embargoes? Thomas Jefferson tried them. Rent too high? We've been arguing about that for a while. Each episode is proof. The past isn't that far away. Listen to History This Week, available now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly on 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Happy Friday, John Hancock.
Back at you.
What a beautiful week we've had here in St. Louis. We're getting ready for one of my favorite weekends of the year.
St. Patrick's Day.
Buddy, the Irish, man. We deserve to be celebrated, don't we?
I suppose.
Yeah. Well, hey, speaking of celebration, let's go into a time machine. I think it was about 10 years ago. There was a proposal to put together a concept of merging St. Louis City and St. Louis County.
Yep.
It was called Better Together.
It was.
It had some flawed pieces related to it. It was going to make the county executive
Steve Stenger
at the time.
Steve Stenger, the king of St. Louis.
Yeah, the regional president. But I'll tell you what, you go back and look at that plan, it was 99.9% right.
Well, it was interesting because, we've got the situation now where Sam Page, who's on his way out as county executive, sparked a lot of discussion yesterday when he said that St. Louis City ought to become a municipality within St. Louis County, thereby merging the two and eliminating a lot of duplicity in services and so forth. It's gotten people talking.
Well, and it's frustrating from my perspective because Sam Page was one of the folks who fought hard against the concept of Better Together. And, well, he's been the county executive for nearly a decade. And during that time, you know how many times he brought this concept up?
Zero.
Zero. I think anybody who's around our region knows well enough that something needs to change. And it's likely that the city and the county ought to find some unification process. But here Sam Page is in the midst of some turmoil. He's been indicted by the attorney general. He's got a court case going on in Springfield, Missouri. And it seems to me in the midst of what is a storm of mud flying around him, is trying to put a white hat on to say, hey, man, I've been thinking about the region. Well, where the heck you been, Sam?
Well, and the interesting thing is, as we have these conversations, and they're important conversations to have, because structurally, the way we're put together doesn't work. And we're proving it every day, every year here in St. Louis. The Better Together proposal would have created St. Louis and the city and the county would all become St. Louis. It was a unification.
Similar to like New York City, right? There would have been divisions, like boroughs almost,
of course,
if you will.
Yes.
But it would have been one giant city.
Right. What Sam Page is talking about is simply including the city of St. Louis as another municipality in St. Louis County. Two very different approaches to unification.
Am I all wet to be thinking that it there has to be something else behind his proposal here or to bring this up at this time? I mean, you literally were sitting in the most powerful position in the region as the St. Louis County executive and never once brought this up. Knowing that St. Louis County continues to lose population for the first time in my lifetime, it's under 1 million people.
Yep.
Which well documented what the slide that's taken place inside the city of St. Louis. And it's clear that this degradation of the St. Louis area has been happening together. And maybe we should be finding a solution together. And here you are, less than 3 months from moving on to wherever you're going to have to go. You're coming up with this concept. It's just frustrating. I am grateful that it's a part of our conversation right now. I hope it's not met with the same resistance that typically is met in St. Louis, which is anytime change comes up, it's met with a ball bat.
Well, look, we've got to talk about this. And so I'm kind of grateful for Sam Page bringing this up because it has engendered a whole lot of discussion. And we've got to start thinking through these things together as a city and a county, because the way we're constituted right now isn't working for anybody. And you're right about the population decline. The other the other population number that is concerning is the median age of the residents of St. Louis City and County. Young people are not staying here. And that's a very wicked stew. And we spend more on government per capita in St. Louis than just about any other place in the country because of the how many services are duplicated. You got county offices in the city that are full of employees. The same offices exist in St. Louis County that are full of employees in the city. Most of them are elected in the county. Most of them are appointed. And it costs too much to govern too few in St. Louis. And, you know, that's not sustainable.
Yeah, and when you look at like same regions, Indianapolis, Louisville, Baltimore, all who face similar
Nashville
structures to what we had, they've rectified it and moved on. You also made reference to Ness Sandoval from Washington University, the professor who's been doing some studies of the St. Louis region. St. Louis County, for the first time, has more people over the age of 60 than under the age of 19. And that's a dooms spiral, a doomsday spiral, as we continue to lose population. St. Louis City, St. Louis County, the St. Louis region provides about 40% of the revenue for the state of Missouri. And the importance of this region to the rest of the state, all these places you've never heard of, and even our friends over in Kansas City, are dependent on the revenue that comes from St. Louis. And if we continue to see that diminish, that's not only a problem for St. Louis, but it's a problem for the great state.
Well, it is. And the entire region is dependent on the city of St. Louis to thrive. And we, you know, we need that to happen on both sides of the river. And so it's a regional issue. And a lot of the demographic trends extend to the entire region as well, not just the city and county.
So, John, what's happened in the past is that folks in maybe Kirkwood and Floor Center and you know, different cities across the St. Louis County have said, wait a minute, man, well, I don't want to lose the identity of our little particular area here, etc.
Yes.
But it seemed, do you think we've reached a point, a sobering point, where folks are going to come to the realization that maybe we are better together in some concept? And does that better together idea, and I don't mean that from the plan that was introduced,
right.
I mean this from the reunification, doesn't the state of Missouri need to show some leadership here? We had a governor run for governor saying, I'm going to fix the St. Louis City Police Department. So he clearly is supposed to care about the region. Shouldn't the state, city, county, shouldn't we have some type of like Uber summit where we come up with a plan and do something rather than have this conversation for two more years and wait until the next crisis hits?
I think it's going to take some time to get folks to warm up to the idea. The fact that the county now has real fiscal issues, you know, for years the argument in the county has been, I don't want to bring the city's problems to St. Louis County.
Right.
Well, now St. Louis County's got real problems of its own, structural budgetary problems. Maybe that's an impetus, but I do think it's going to take some time. To your point about the municipalities, we've got to figure out a way to retain the identity of those municipalities so people feel comfortable that they're from Kirkwood, they're from Webster Groves.
I'm Susie Welch, the host of Becoming You, a podcast where I help you stop living by default and start living by design. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to the Hancock and Kelly Show. John, we are slipping into day 13 of the war over in Iran. President Trump continues to say he's keeping the throttle down, and it appears as though we have air superiority over Iran. This morning, I watched a press conference with Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, who started it off with attacking the media. I still don't find why we're trying to fight a media battle here when we really just ought to be reporting what's ultimately happening. What's your take on where we stand in the war? Is this something we're winning, and how long, much longer could it go on?
Well, I don't know that we've defined what winning is yet. The administration's been all over the map in terms of what the objective was going in. It was regime change. It was stopping the nuclear program. It was, rendering them unable to attack their neighbors in Israel. So, you know, I don't know. I'm at a loss to know exactly what the objective is. We're going to visit with Colonel Jeff McCausland at 8:40 this morning. Maybe he can help us understand some of this. And you've already seen we're now over 10 American service people who have died fighting this war in Iran. And, you know, I'm struck, Michael, when we started the Kuwait war under George H.W. Bush in 1991. He did an address to the nation. He laid out what was happening. Saddam Hussein had gone in and dominated Kuwait, and we fought a war to liberate that country, and we were successful there, and it was short. When George W. Bush went into Afghanistan and then ultimately Iraq, they laid out, it was wrong, but they laid out a rationale of why we were doing it before anything started. And they went to Congress, Colin Powell, saying they've got weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You remember all of that? Turned out to be bogus, but they made a case for the effort, and the Congress authorized it, approved it. This has been seemingly out of the blue.
And in those previous conflicts, both of which were started under Republicans, much like this conflict, those conflicts, we built a world coalition to support us. This time we went in on our own. Now, because of some of the actions that Iran has taken, it's helped bring some of the neighbors down there to our aid. But it's just essentially been us and Israel. We now are learning that Russia is giving some intelligence and help to Iran. I find that to be interesting while we sit on the sidelines and what's happening in Ukraine.
Because the Russian effort, which our intelligence community, through reporting, we know this, they've been aiding and helping to target American facilities for Iran. And our response to that is to lift sanctions on Russia so that they can export their oil. It's a puzzle to me.
And we will learn more and more, especially as this continues to go on. They are saying that we should be prepared for more American deaths and expenses to go up. John, I was out of town in Florida. I encountered $4.50 gasoline a gallon.
It's getting up there. That's Michael Kelly. I'm John Hancock.
John, with so much going on in the world, it's hard to remember at times. We've got baseball that started, right?
Yes.
Pitchers, catchers, and spring training's underway.
Yes.
Down in Jupiter, Florida.
We're less than 2 weeks from opening day.
Less than 2 weeks. But boy, there is an unbelievable thing going on right now in the World Baseball Classic. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to watch any of it.
Seen a little bit.
This last week, I got an opportunity with Dave Glover and Tom Ackerman to go down to Miami and see Venezuela and the Dominican Republic play each other.
Yeah.
An absolutely incredible game. I think it finished 7-3-4, something like that. But an atmosphere unlike any baseball game I've ever been to, and I've been to some really great Cardinal games.
More than a World Series game.
More than a World Series game.
Wow.
Now, obviously, being in a Cardinal World Series game, you're caught up in the personal emotions of Cardinals, so those take front and center in my memory. But outside of that, any game that wasn't a Cardinal World Series game, it was one of the most incredible experiences. It felt like a World Cup game, a soccer game. You had folks from both sides, very happy, chanting, concerts. The energy in that ballpark felt like a World Series game. Every pitch, people were cheering, screaming, yelling. And it's just exciting to see baseball evoke this type of emotion and then to be able to couple it with that Olympic / nationalistic pride was really fun to witness.
Well, yeah, and you've got these, the game is such a passion for a lot of the Latin countries, and so that was interesting. You say it was Venezuela and the Dominican.
Yes, Albert Pujols was the manager of the Dominican. I saw him taking throws over at first base, saw him with his hand on the cage. He has essentially got an all-star team there with all the players he has, from Tatis to you go down the list one after another
That every member of the Dominican team is an active Major League Baseball player, right?
I mean,
it would have to
be. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if Tom Ackerman was here, he'd be able to list the the roster for me, and he kept saying to me, "Can you go believe this guy's hitting seventh?" And I'd say, "No, I can't, because I don't know who he is either way." But I'm telling you, the energy in this park was so much fun. And then the way they did it, John, with it was in Miami, but it was front and center was Venezuela's national anthem,
uh-huh.
Dominican Republic's national anthem. They brought out stars from both of those countries. The energy that existed, it has me excited for where this tournament is headed over the next couple of weeks.
Well, and the U.S. got to breathe a sigh of relief after their manager miscalculated the standings and almost blew it by not playing his best players or pitching his best pitchers in the game against Italy.
Yeah, and they had a situation here where if you have a tie, it goes to runs against you, similar to what we've seen in soccer. I saw Adam Wainwright yesterday
defending
on Twitter.
Defending
Mark DeRosa, saying, hey, this isn't as easy as everybody thinks it is. He was making long-term judgments. The other thing that was cool about this taking place when it does is it's not the dominance of one pitcher because it's early in a year. Unlike a World Series game, you get a pitcher that can come in there, he could throw 7-8 innings and be the complete dominant story. That wasn't the case in the World Baseball Classic with these folks just getting started. It really put both defense and offense on display.
And a lot of these individual players have regulations on them from their teams about how many innings they can pitch and so forth. That's Michael Kelly. I'm John Hancock. Colonel Jeff McCausland on the Iran War next on KMOX.
We are now joined by Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News military analyst. Colonel McCausland, thanks for joining us on KMOX. And we all are reading about the downing of the KC-135 over the friendly skies of Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely, without question. Obviously, preliminary reports are limited at the moment. The aircraft did go down without a doubt, had a crew of six. Four sadly were killed, two were recovered, no reports on their condition, obviously no names released or the unit that they were assigned with, likely conducting aerial refueling operations over western Iraq, safe airspace, which the Air Force does routinely. And in many ways, when we talk about the fighters and the bombers that are going in to deliver ordnance on target, the refuelers are the backbone of an air campaign. Without the refuelers, that doesn't happen. And it's a pretty amazing operation. I've actually been on board when they occurred. You might think the fuselage is all fuel. Actually, it's not. It's wide open. And they can carry a few passengers. That's what I was doing. I was hitching a ride. Or some cargo. The fuel for refueling is actually in the belly of the plane and in the wings. But literally, you walk back to the back. You crawl down into a glass bubble on the belly of the airplane with the boom operator. And then he literally flies this pipe, which has got wings on it, as an aircraft comes up, plugs into that pipe, you refuel it, they pull off, and you go on to the next guy. So for the Air Force and the guys who do this and gals who do this, it's a pretty routine operation. But I got to tell you, when you're doing that about, flying several hundred miles an hour at 15, 20,000 feet, it's a pretty amazing event.
Yeah, and you would, it's almost amazing that these kinds of accidents don't happen more frequently, given the just immensely difficult task that is.
Yeah, and it's done hundreds and thousands. I'm sure in this particular campaign alone, it's been done hundreds and if not thousands of times to keep the aircraft over target for surveillance or because they're actually escorting bombers or they're actually employing ordnance. So it's done that many times, but as routine, I've talked to pilots who've been involved either as refuelers or as the people being refueled, and they can say the challenge is maintaining constant airspeed. The two aircraft have got to really maintain very, very close constant airspeed. If one speeds up, slows down, then you got a problem. Obviously, as well, if you hit air turbulence, since you're flying on, you suddenly hit air turbulence, that could cause a major problem. In fact, both pilots and both aircraft, as well as the boom operator, are trained if anything seems to go wrong, you immediately start hollering, breakaway, breakaway, breakaway on the radio, and you immediately break away. The lead aircraft, the refueler, pulls up and gains altitude. The refueled aircraft breaks away, cuts to the left, and drops altitude as quickly as you can.
Colonel Jeff McCausland is our guest, CBS News military analyst. The rationale for getting involved in this conflict, to at least in my civilian eyes, has seemed to be all over the board. Was there a clear rationale to enter this? And And what do you see as the clear objective of the U.S. military here?
Well, in my military eyes, it's unclear, too. So we're in the same boat here. One journalist who tracked this closely claimed he'd come up with 10 different reasons why the war occurred now. Now, there was a very sad history between the United States and Iran. There's no doubt about it. You can go back to 1979, seizure of our embassy, holding of hostages for over 400 days. 1983, suicide bomber Beirut, Lebanon, supported by the Iranians, kills over 200 Marines. Throughout the war in Iraq, the Iranians were providing improvised explosive devices and other weapons to Iraqi militia groups that killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans. Curiously, the Iranians actually provided us support in the war in Afghanistan because they had no love for the Taliban. So actually, we were allied in some particular places, and we were kind of indirectly allied in a way in the campaign over the last few years to try to destroy ISIS in northern Iraq. But overall, a sad history. And the president said, you know, it's time. This is sort of payback for all that that has occurred in the past. We've talked about, of course, how terrible they are to their population. And it is an enormously repressive regime. It's killed thousands of their people. But I think the real key here is there was no clear, imminent threat that Iran posed to the United States. All the talk about them getting ready to attack us, there's been no evidence of that. There was no real evidence of them having the imminent capacity to produce a nuclear weapon. Even as this began, the Secretary of State, Mr. Rubio, said they were not reprocessing any uranium further beyond what they already have done. So that the cause, you're right, is somewhat vague, to say the least. And then the end state is also, and that makes it hard for military people like me who look at military power as being applied to create a political end state. But if I can't figure out what the end state is, that's hard to do. And we've had at least three that I can tell. One is to blunt their missile capacity to threaten our bases and our friends in the region. Second is to destroy their nuclear facilities so they can't build a nuclear weapon. Well, you can do those two things, but to verify they can't recover, you're going to have to put boots on the ground to make sure that they're not reconstituting or some kind of capacity to do that. And last but not least, we've been back and forth on, are we in favor of regime change or not? I mean, the president said, oh, unconditional surrender from the Iranians. Well, that's the Japanese on the deck of the battleship Missouri, which means we're going to turn over all our weapons and whatever political choices are made are going to be made by you. And we actually ruled Japan for several years thereafter.
Colonel Jeff McCausland is our guest. And Colonel, you laid out what's happening in Iran right now. But the one of the consequences of this conflict is the Strait of Hormuz now finds itself inoperable and the global economy looks like it may be coming to a screeching halt. Was this an oversight or was this expected?
Well, it should have been expected. I mean, I've been through war games involving Iran probably for the last 20 years before I retired from the Army. And in every war game with Iran, the Iranians were trying to close the Straits of Hormuz. And you can go back to the tanker wars in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, and we were escorting naval vessels through the Straits of Hormuz for that particular reason. The challenge is the way to do that has changed dramatically. Back in those days, it was mainly a concern of the missiles being launched from shore, striking tankers traveling through this narrow strait of about 20 miles, or perhaps sea mines. Well, those two capabilities still remain, but the bigger threat now seems to be, of course, the drone. And we've seen 16 ships hit. Most of those, as I can tell, have been hit by drones. But the Iranians were able to employ not only aerial drones, but drones at sea, which are unmanned boats full of explosives and that can be directed to strike a tanker. And as long as they can make those ships feel vulnerable to any of those three threats, then the maritime companies are not going to move. They're not going to be able to get any insurance. And everything's going to stop. So normally we have about 80 tankers passing through the straits on any single day. Now we're down to one or two. In fact, the biggest exporter of oil coming out of the Straits of Hormuz right now is Iran because they don't shoot at their tankers.
That's just crazy. We've just got a little bit of time left, but I wanted to ask you, Russia providing aid to Iran, the U.S. removing sanctions on Russian oil. What do you make of this?
Well, Russians are the big winner. The Russians have been the big winner in this war. I mean, as you suggest, we cut down on the sanctions on the export of oil so they can export oil. That is the primary export that the Russians have and the primary contributor to their economy, which has been kind of on the rocks over the last few weeks and months because of the war in Ukraine. Big, big benefit there. Is anybody talking about the war in Ukraine right now, even though we're past the four-year anniversary of Russian aggression? No, we're not talking about that at all. We're all fixated on what's going on in Iran. Curiously, during these last couple of weeks, the Ukrainians have actually recovered some territory. They've actually been on the counteroffensive a little bit. Thirdly, we know that the Russians are providing intelligence to the Iranians about the location of U.S. ships, aircraft, et cetera. They did the same thing with the Houthis in the Red Sea. And our senior negotiator, Mr. Witkoff, said, well, the Russians say they aren't doing that and we should take them at their word. Really? Take the Russians at their word? Are you serious? And then last but not least, of course, in the middle of all this, the President of the United States, Mr. Trump, calls Mr. Putin, which may seem insignificant, but I got to tell you, is enormously important to Putin. He wants to be on the world stage. He wants to be treated as an equal to the United States, and he wants to be treated as a participant, even though he's irrelevant in many ways in this conflict. And that's exactly what we did.
Great stuff, as always, from Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News military analyst. Thanks so much for your time.
Welcome back to the Hancock and Kelly Show. John, this week, we're getting ready for the Missouri legislature to go on break.
They finished up yesterday.
And prior to their departure, the Missouri House of Representatives, they passed Governor Kehoe's number one priority, which is doing away with the state income tax. Now, that doesn't happen immediately. It has to go to the Senate. The Senate, too, would have to support that idea, and then it would go to the voters.
Correct.
And the voters would do it. And my understanding is it's got some convoluted scale-back provision that if we meet certain goals, they'll start to roll back pieces of the state income tax.
I think convoluted is an unfortunate choice of words.
Well, it's my choice. Right. You might feel differently. But here we are. It's interesting to me at a time that we're cutting budgets. We have a sales tax here in the city of St. Louis, which is almost like 12-15%. We're going to impose sales taxes to do away with income taxes in the state of Missouri. And those people who've never in the past had to charge sales tax, I'm thinking of lawyers, people who cut hair for a living, maybe the cleaning folks who come and clean the house, you and I, the services we provide, are suddenly going to be moved into sales taxes. Yeah. First of all, does this have the support of the general public in polling? And is this really the best way to go about doing away with the state income tax?
Let me answer those two questions. Yes and yes. Look, states that don't have income taxes empirically are growing, are thriving. It's a huge incentive for folks to come and do business in states that have no personal income tax. So, and I think the way Missouri's going about it by requiring a vote of the people, I think that's wise. By phasing it out and not in one full swoop getting rid of it, which is what they did in Kansas, it really messed them up badly. Phasing it out over 5 years, I think, is a very prudent way to go. I think it makes Missouri more competitive, and the public will have to be, by definition, the way this is being done, the public will have to be bought in to making this change.
Ultimately, won't this be some of the biggest tax increases that have ever been imposed on the voters of the state of Missouri? Because you're going to be coming up with a whole new host of taxes that have to be implemented to replace the income tax. And I get it. A lot of folks on the lower end of the economy don't even pay state income tax. Those in the middle, we pay it, and the people at the top pay it the most. Aren't they the ones who are going to benefit the most? And do you really think that financial guys from New York are going to be fleeing New York because of high taxes to come to Missouri?
Yeah, I do. John. The taxes in New York are very high, and yeah, I do think Missouri becomes more appealing. And here's the thing about the tax shift. Because we are doing a sales tax, and there'll probably be some corporate tax movement as well to make up
some
for the
tax increases there. Yeah.
Okay. Some of the business groups are concerned about that, it has to happen. But think about my own business. If I'm charging sales tax, a huge percent of my business is from non-Missouri entities. And then when you factor in the tourism that exists in the state of Missouri, a lot of the a lot of the revenue burden, a good chunk of the revenue burden is going to be paid by non-Missourians.
But the barber, the school teacher now, when they go out to do their shopping and they purchase their detergent, they buy their shampoo, all of that's now increased costs that they weren't facing when there was an income tax being paid mainly by the top.
Yep, it's going to be a good thing for the state. That's Michael Kelly. I'm John Hancock.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.